So just by way of a brief introduction, I wanted to say that Barbara and I are bringing this material to you from our personal experience, from our experience with our clients and friends and teachers. We believe there is a way with engaging with and interacting with the large field of life to heal past wounds and to participate in creating change. We want to share our work at a time when there are significant shifts in consciousness that are occurring in the world, which can be overwhelming. We believe people need ways to consciously participate in shaping the change so that we can experience excitement instead of fear and helplessness. We believe that through intentional interaction with this energetic field, we can heal old wounds and affect the form the new world consciousness will take. And I want to add, too, that this is a very brief introduction of our work. We normally present this in weekend workshops or groups that run over a period of, you know, 6 months or so. But we really just want to try to give you a taste of what it is that we're doing.
I'm going to just stand up to read this because I was planning to have my computer in front of me. But being a flexible person, I've now learned to do this. Okay. This is a quote from Carl Jung. "'Tis the conscious mind often knows little or nothing about its own transformation and does not want to know anything. The more autocratic it is and the more convinced of the eternal validity of its truths, the more it identifies with them. Thus, the kingship of Saul, which is a natural phenomena, passes to the human king who personifies the prevailing dominant idea and must therefore share its fate. In the phenomenal world, the law of everlasting change prevails, and it seems that all true things must change and that only that which changes remains true." Now that business, he was a Latin scholar and had a classical education, so the kingship of Saul and all that part of it is whatever the dominant cultural idea is, whether it's enlightenment thinking, materialism, the military-industrial complex, or whatever comes next, always is changing and has to give up, and we experience loss with this when the dominant idea changes, and that is the nature of things. It's like Buddhism. It's like constant change, letting go. So I want to start out by forming a temenos, which is an, oops, there we go, which is another Jungian Latin word. And it means to form a sacred space, usually thought of as a circle, in which we can invite in messages from unconscious or non-linear, non-rational sources, mystical sources, transpersonal sources, in a way that we can interact with them so that they don't overwhelm us, but that we can work with them and engage with them. So I almost always start with the Buddhist prayer for teachers and students. And there it is. It's a Sanskrit prayer that in the Yoga Sutras, it's the beginning of the teaching. May the Eternal guide us all. Please come right in. May the Eternal protect us all. May we all make a bold attempt. Which is my favorite line. You just need to make a bold attempt. May our studies illuminate us, and may no difference come between us. In the name of the Eternal, may there be peace, peace, peace. The other part that I always point out is the no difference come between us part, because it doesn't mean that we won't have our differences. That's normal. But that they won't come between us, that we'll respect them and work with them.
So I just want to be able to give you a little bit of an overview of what we're going to be taking a look at tonight. We're going to explore how engaging with non-rational sources of information can inform and enliven our lives. to explore ways of gaining information through engaging in the interactive field between the rational and the non-rational, thereby changing consciousness. To explain how Jung engaged in this process of healing and transformation of consciousness. We're also going to take a look at shamanic traditions and their use of engaging non-rational sources of information for healing and transformation. And then to briefly consider why to engage with the implicit non-mental world, how to engage it, how to encourage transformation in ourselves and others. And then at the end, I'd like to discuss with our responsibility engaging with the interactive field in order to participate in creating the form this new consciousness will take. So that's just a bit of an overview of what we'll be looking at. And these are maybe, we're going to go into this next slide in a little more depth later on in our talk, but something to maybe hold as we're talking is, you know, why engage with information gained from non-rational sources? And we believe that it's to gain clarity and direction and guidance. We want to be able to connect to other fields of potential and receive the energy that is in those sources. To be able to use the information to make meaning in order to create a new story for ourselves. And that we believe, too, that repeated interaction with these non-rational sources, transpersonal realms, deepens that connection and continues to deepen how it informs us as well.
So, here we go. We're going to use two examples of ways, of traditional ways or ways that other people have tried to engage information from the non-mental world. And Jung is the one that I know the best, along with the Buddhist way, which we aren't going to talk about today. But he had a way of engaging with images that he produced and that were given to him in his psyche, working with the images and changing his whole structure of his personality. Most of his theory came from this experience that he had. And it had changed his center of gravity. So I'm going to give you like the biggest brush, you know, broad brush stroke kind of view of Jung. We could spend a semester on it, but you know, Doris and I are both really intuitive people. And so if we can make leaps of intuition. So if we leave out something that, if we make one of those leaps and you're not following us, please let us know. And then we'll fill in our assumptions. We've been told that. But so let's see. Jung, what Jung called the non-rational, he called it the unconscious. And in all of his writings, he talks about going into what is unconscious, which is really, we don't know yet, and finding ways of getting that information and bringing it in to inform us. And to work with, use your mental, rational mind to work with that material and to form a new space. So I wanted just to define what he thought of in his time that is conscious and unconscious. And, you know, things have changed. Now we notice and recognize various kinds of consciousness, not just mental consciousness, but in those days, conscious was defined as rational, cognitive, masculine, left brain, brain as mind. Brain and mind are one. And what we call explicit knowing instead of implicit knowing, ego and will. They thought of conscious as masculine and unconscious as feminine. So you'll love these definitions of unconscious here. Irrational, erotic, emotional, instinctual, as I said, feminine, right-brained, implicit knowing, imaginative, nature and body. Things were pretty split in those days, masculine, feminine. conscious, unconscious, mental. And what was feminine and unconscious was not respected. So, you know, it was, and so actually he was very, he made a really bold move in believing that that part of our psyche had something to offer in his times. Let me give you a little bit of information about his cultural context. I was a history teacher. This is pretty broad. But you'll see that from starting from about 2500 BCE, things started to get centralized. People moved into cities, so globally, you know, things began to get to centralize and they became hierarchical. In the mind, like humans became figural from the background and became the most important thing before. I'll show you some slides. It was like a two-dimensional world with expansive horizons. Gradually, humans became the central figure, and the human vision became the way we saw things, which was three-dimensional and kind of narrowed. The Age of Enlightenment, in broad brush strokes, made man the center of the universe. I'll show you some pictures that will demonstrate that. And the Age of Science and Reason, it's one of my all-time favorite quotes. This is from the Royal Society of Science. The Age of Reason brought forth a masculine birth of time that would issue in a blessed race of heroes and supermen. A force that could hound, conquer, and subdue nature, shake her to her foundations, storm and occupy her castles and strongholds. The society's purpose, as explained by its secretary Henry Ohlenberg, was to raise a masculine philosophy where the minds of men may be ennobled with the knowledge of solid truths. It's easy to sort of to disrespect the Age of Science as because we've become too one-sided and too scientific and materialistic. But actually, it was quite a pull out of the Middle Ages. And there were obviously a lot of benefits to the Age of Science, but it became very one-sided. So here's the, just to give you, it's much better. Well, some people understand things better in images and the feeling, and some in words, so I thought I'd show you the image. This is an old picture of a sort of a two-dimensional nature where you can see there are no boundaries, no horizons. It's open. The space is open. You could go forever. Here's the Vitruvian man. You know, Leonardo da Vinci's man became the center of the universe, and everything was seen through our eye, which narrowed the horizon. So we saw three-dimensionally, but we saw in a narrow view. I want to give you a little bit about information about the context of his life. And I'm doing this in order to give you a feeling for how heretical his thinking was for his life and his times and where he came from, and what a big movement he made in bringing up this material from the unconscious. When he was young, in his autobiography, which is called Memories, Dreams, Reflections, it was mostly written by him, but also then he, after he died, some of the other people continued and finished the book. But he recorded realizing that he had two personalities. One was what he later called the personality of the times, which was mental, heroic, centered on the ego, centered on making a place for oneself in the world, becoming a man of science. You know, he was one of the presidents of the Psychoanalytic Association with Freud. He founded one of the journals, made quite an established career. Personality number two was his mother was, had held seances in the house. He had experiences where he he saw images of ghosts and heard sounds and that he couldn't explain. They're all written up in his book. But he decided at one point to bury this personality and go with personality number one. And he had this little figure, this little mannequin, and he symbolically buried it in the attic. I think he was like 9 or 10. So later he understood what he was doing, but even then he knew he had to bury this part of himself, which he did. But as he went along in his life, the repression of this part of himself, which was what he called the unconscious, came up in really strong emotional feelings, erotic relationships, overpowering feelings, and he had to face them, and I'll tell you a little bit about how he did that. It kind of swamped him like a tsunami, and the way he faced them is what he later called active imagination. So I'll tell you a little bit about that, but you'll see, you know, where he was coming from. In his work, and again, it's like super brief, but I'm laughing because I, you know, in order to pass my exams, I think I knew like Jung's anniversary and not my own. You know, it's like, yeah. even at the beginning of his writing, his dissertation was on his cousin, Helly Perswick, which was about the psychology of somnambulance. Of, you know, and she was had some psychic experiences, and that he began to underneath his man of reason all the way along, you could see this other understanding coming through, that he felt there was a force or a source that was guiding people to become more conscious, more whole, and not in the sense of only positive things, more whole in the sense of owning shadow, owning the negative, but also reaching into to the non-rational sources, and that we were guided. It was purposeful. The things happened in a purposeful way. He saw symptoms as purposeful messengers. Like, for example, if you break your arm and there's pain, the pain is the symptom. It's not the problem. It's like an arrow, like something's wrong. So he began to be less judgmental about people's mental health symptoms. For example, he saw the symptoms of a schizophrenic patient that he worked with in the Burkholtzy Clinic where he did his residency. And he would listen to these people and talk to these people and realize that there was some kind of sense going on to what they were saying on the basis of their life, that it wasn't just random. And although a lot of these things we take somewhat for granted now as ideas of how we work with people, it was not done then. You know, we're just moving out of hopefully we're moving out of some of the diagnostic categories and the blaming and shaming of people that way. He believed in the existence of the unconscious, which even today in normal academic psychology and social work and counseling programs, it is not a popular thought. Today, most therapists work with cognitive behavioral psychology, which is very good and works very well for some people, but it denies the existence of the past and that psychological symptoms are purposeful and have, and the honoring of defenses and the belief in the unconscious. So. It's really kind of almost difficult to paint the picture of the thinking then, because so much of it has been taken into our popular culture now and the way we treat. So he and Freud were very close for a while and had you know, this belief in the unconscious together. They both believed in that and they both worked with that, and he respected a lot of what Freud did, but as time went on and he began to write and think and experience, he found some very major differences with Freud and with most of the psychological world. And some of these differences are, Freud had the idea that libido, or psychic energy, was basically from repressed incest wishes and sexuality. Jung believed, I know. Jung believed that libido or psychic energy was broad and had a vast variety of sources, and especially a source of looking for meaning in life, that we were energized and driven, you know, among other things, to find a spiritual meaning for our life. Again, he saw the incest idea as symbolic, and like the desire for rebirth, for coming to a new position, for giving up the old and being somehow psychologically born again into a new place, not an actual wish for incest with the parent, and for Freud mainly the mother, that that was like just too reductive and too concrete, that it was really a more symbolic wish than that. And he moved eventually from seeing the conscious mind or ego as the center, which Freud did, and to seeing what he called the self as the center, which we might call the source, or that like shamans would call the source, the quiet, the emptiness of Buddhism, that sort of thing, that there was an ever-present source coming through that was the center of things, and that the ego was only a lesser kind of mental thing that we could use and needed to live. So, sounds like a simple, you know, it sounds very logical and like, well, yes, now I believe this. But for him, it tore apart his whole personality. Mm-hmm. And he faced this huge onslaught of emotions, broke with Freud, had a near psychotic break. Mm-hmm. And during this time, he wrote journals. He had images that came up for him that he worked with, and I'll talk a little bit about those, and worked with his conscious mind with these images, which were images from his feelings that took on a visual form for him, and he worked with them, and it changed his psyche. Now, he felt that these images were not a fantasy, that his ego didn't make them up, that they came to him, they were real. They were real energies that he was working with, not a fantasy. So he journaled in some books that they call the black books. He pulled himself together through this journaling process and changed himself. And then he took the whole body of work, and for a long period of time, he did drawings and writings and wrote what he would call the Red Book, which you've probably heard of, that was just published a couple of years ago. So this is the process that Doris and I have studied in various traditions, that we have worked with ourselves and our clients and friends, where you'd have a reciprocal relationship, mm-hmm, with a non-rational source. For him, these images, he worked in an interactive process with them, and it's this, that's why we call the work engaging, which is the process of change. That if you engage with these sources, however they come to you, and for him it was in these images, drastic, big changes or incremental changes result. So I'm going to show you a couple of his images so that you can get more of a feel for what the heck I'm talking about with him. But if you take a look at the Red Book and read it at all, I was new to Chicago, and my friend was giving a talk on the Red Book, and she wrote me into giving it, like, how could I say no? And then I had to read it. So, and I was amazed. I really was amazed. It made me respect Jung so much more, because he really worked and battled and with these energies in himself. And I was really impressed. So here's one of them. The first, I just chose three, but to me they were some of the major ones. This is the guy was called Ishtabar, and he was an image of the mythological man. And he came to Jung, and I'll read you a little bit, a mini amount of a dialogue, so you get an idea of what the dialogue was like. Let's see if I can find him. Hold on a sec. Yeah, here he is. Okay, so Jung, Ishtabar says, "Have you no gods anymore?" Jung says, "Science has taken from us the capacity of belief." Ishtabar says, "Are there two kinds of truth?" Jung says, "It seems to me to be so. Our truth is that which comes to us from the knowledge of outer things. The truth of your priests is that which come to you from inner things." When he met this energy, he was afraid of it. His ego had a big response to it, which our egos do have to change. He says, like any growth for the self, the big source, is felt as a loss to the ego. And so he diminished him in his imagination, put him in an egg and put him in his pocket. And then as time went on and he was working out all of these things, he let him free again and was able to allow in the kind of mythological consciousness. So a lot of Jung's work ended up to be with myth and fairy tale as ways of gaining information. Then here's the second one. This is the killing of the hero Siegfried. And he had some terrifying dreams at the beginning of a psychic break, which actually were precognitive dreams about his own psyche breaking down and the loss of the heroic ego. But also they happened synchronistically with the beginning of World War I. So he wasn't sure if he was taking in the collective and that's why he was having dreams about this, or whether it was about himself and he realized it was synchronistic, that it was both. Then the last one is the feminine. For him, in his psyche, the feminine came in the form of the woman that he called Salome. She appeared to him with the prophet Elijah. Salome, just to give you an idea of how despicable he found and scary he found the feminine, you'll know that the story of Salome is that she talked her stepfather Herod into killing John the Baptist, beheading John the Baptist. Quite a feminine to deal with him. And that's Jung's mother, just to give you an idea. That's his wife, and this is a woman, one of the women that he had one of his many affairs with. And I feel that that was part of his this repression of the erotic and the body that was so prevalent for him in his Swiss culture.
How did his wife deal with all the?
You know, it's interesting. She is the one that had the money. She was one of the wealthiest women in Switzerland. When one marries there, all of the property and money goes to the man. I don't know if it's still true today. It was then. They had children. She ran the household. And there was one woman that he had a long-standing affair with, Toni Wolff, and they. You know, she would come to the house. They would have dinner together. I don't know. I mean, I saw a play that someone wrote about Toni and Emma Young getting together and talking about what was going on. I don't think separation or divorce was an option at all. So I really don't know how they personally dealt with this.
So this was all on his own.
Oh, I don't know about that either.
He wrote in his journals.
Yes, he wrote and wrote in his journals, but he didn't write. If he wrote about his personal life and how it was dealt with, they haven't published it. He built a house on a lake, and he built it mostly by hand. And he during this time, he made many carvings in the house at Bollingen, and carved out the feelings that were going through him. He cooked on a wood stove and stayed there by himself. This period of the intensity of this period lasted about 5 or 6 months until he worked through all this and came through it. So he believed that the process of change occurred through interaction with what he called the mythopoetic field, which we're calling, the transpersonal sources. And that he believed that if you hold the tension of opposites, for him, between conscious and unconscious, mental and imaginative, that if you hold and honor them both and don't repress one or deny one, that eventually you will come to a whole new position, which he did, and it wasn't, I mean, there's a lot to be said for how much further he could have gone, but I mean, he's one man, had one lifetime, so, and he called that the transcendent function. So let's see, here you go. Do you have any brief questions about that? Did that follow for you?
I just have a question on the images again. Were the images sort of the seeds of his developing the archetype theories?
Great question. Yeah, they were. He felt that at the core, let's say he had this complex about mythology and the ego, and the fear that he had about letting the mythological in and what that would do to his psyche. And he felt that at the core of every psychological complex that we have, there's a personal part of the complex, and then there's the core that would be archetypal. And that archetypal core of the, let's say, the mythological man would be what informs the personal complex. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. Anything else before we go ahead? Microphone?
Question?
Yeah.
I read someplace that when he was building his home in Bollinger, that he had dedicated his home to one of his guides called Philemon, mm-hmm. who was like a messenger, almost like Mercury with the winged feet. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit. I mean, there's so much to know. He had, in his, if you read through the book and his journals, well, actually the journals are just coming out, but if you read through the Red Book, he had wisdom figure, like Elijah, the guy that we saw in there, was the beginning of it, and he developed this wisdom figure into this character, Philemon, who you're talking about, and that this wisdom figure taught him how to integrate his psyche. Yeah. And it was a very calming kind of thing for him, calming his anxiety, because it was like the wisdom, the source of the wise man. He didn't respect his father. He thought his father and Emma's father were both ministers. And he felt that his father had lost connection with any mysticism or real belief in the church, and that was just mouthing the words and being a minister. And so he needed a father figure that was something that he could relate to, and he found it in Philemon. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I'd like to have us take a little time and consider the ancient healing traditions of shamanism. Because they offer their own perspective, that tradition offers its own perspective on expanding consciousness. It's also an area of personal interest to me and something that I've been a student of for quite a few years now. I was given permission by Carl Greer, who's a Jungian analyst and practicing shaman in Chicago, to reference his soon-released book, Change Your Story, Change Your Life, Using Shamanic Tools for Personal Transformation. So I'll be referencing some from his book. He talks about how shamans work with energy, they heal, they retrieve things from the past, They can predict future probabilities and possibilities. I think what really distinguishes the shamans is their belief in the power of the consciousness in nature, in alternative realities, in the space before things have even become manifested into tangible everyday reality. The shamans relate to and become one with the natural world. They can also call up spirits from ancestors or go to particular places in nature, such as mountains, rivers, lakes, for aid in their healing and transformation. And what they do is they interact, they negotiate and interact with these energies to gain information and bring about change in this reality. So they're negotiating in transpersonal realms in order to bring it back into everyday life. So they are co-creating with Source or co-creating within this field. And so what I mean by that, I can think of an example recently where I was going for a walk and I came across this, you know, beautiful willow tree. And I stood in and I took in the energy of that tree. I was compelled by it. I was drawn by it. I looked at its beauty and, you know, I don't know if you probably know willow trees. They're just so incredibly graceful. And the way the wind was capturing the trees and the way the sun was capturing the trees, and it seemed so incredibly in harmony with the elements around it, and that it almost seemed like it was floating, actually. But then as I gazed down into the base of the tree, it was enormous. You know, its roots, you could tell they were thick, that the base of the tree was thick, the roots were incredibly thick, and I thought to myself, you know, there's a teaching here in this moment from this tree and this consciousness is that, you know, the importance of being deeply connected to the earth, to being deeply embodied and grounded in order for myself, the teaching was for me, to be open to these different fields of consciousness and stay grounded as I'm doing it. You know, that if it weren't for the base of this tree, it would have fallen over. It would have blown away. And so that both were needed, a groundedness and a connected to the earth, a connection to the earth and one's body, but also an openness to the fields of energy and consciousness around us. So that is, you know, an example of a way to engage nature and consciousness that I believe exists in all things, that there's teachings in all things in all moments. and I think one of the things that also distinguishes, and it's a very important aspect of shamanism to establish a dialogue, to be in dialogue with and relationship with whatever they encounter. So, you know, for example, I could have been in a hurry and on my way to a meeting or running late for something, or maybe I didn't even have time for the walk, or I was walking so quickly I didn't even notice the tree. Or I could have noticed it, but just kept on going. But I paid attention to the pull within myself that felt compelled towards it and stopped and really engaged it and really took it in and allowed the consciousness that was in there to emerge for me. The shamans also journey to transpersonal realms in order to connect to the energies of those places. And it's one of the ways that they expand their consciousness. They believe, the shamans, that it's the journeys themselves into these transpersonal realms that hold the potential to transform your energetic, mythic, psychological, and physical bodies. And it's strikingly similar to our understanding of active imagination, as Barbara just laid out from Jung's perspective and his process, is occurring within a relational field. You know, Jung had to relate to these images within his psyche. But here, the field is kind of widened. It's not just the images emerging within one's psyche, but it's widening, it's ever-widening fields of energetic connections, right, that can occur, again, in nature, you know, in you know, they might come in the form of guiding figures. You know, the shamans often talk about spirit guides that come to them or spirit animals that have information for them. So these guiding figures from transpersonal energies, the shamans believe that these energies are real. And just as Jung considered the energies of his own imaginal engagements as real. So in Greer's book, he talks about how these energies and insights that are accessible to us in transpersonal realms are often difficult, if not even impossible, to attain in an ordinary state of consciousness. It's an important aspect that we'll talk a little bit more about later. But he talks about how the past and the present and the future exist simultaneously. So that in the journey work allows you to bring into your personal energy field the energies that can alter the quality of your memories. So they no longer can hold you in the same sort of way, that you can change the way the past lives within you. So that, for example, you know, a memory that may have caused you grief or sorrow or anger or regret could perhaps end up leaving you feeling courageous if you could understand it from a different perspective or wise or strong. So it's basically stating that these energies that we can encounter in transpersonal realms serve as an organizing principle that can actually change your vibrational energy. So as a result, then you could feel less inclined to engage in old patterns and actually more available to yourself to make different kinds of choices for your life. There are a variety of different types of journeys that the shamans do. They do the journey to the lower world, or what's often called soul retrieval. And this is a journey where we can retrieve perhaps a wounded part of ourselves that has been split off, or perhaps a part that has been completely unlived. They can do a journey to the upper world. Oops, excuse me. And that is the world of our becoming. And then they do journeys to the quiet, which is before things began, before anything was formed. So those are an example of some of the types of journeys that the shamans can take. And I remember earlier in my shamanic studies, I was taking a journey to the upper world. And you're guided in the journey to the upper world into different chambers of your life. So it's your relational life, spiritual life, vocational life, into these different chambers to see what figures, what images, what information may come up about those particular areas in your life. And I remember having the conscious thought as one of the chambers was relational life that I was journeying to. And I remember having the conscious thought as I was getting ready to journey into the relational realm and thinking, well, you know, this part of my life is actually going pretty well. So this will be kind of interesting. My relationships are in pretty good shape. And so I wonder what's going to happen, you know, as I journey into this place. And what ended up happening is I journeyed into that chamber and there was a warrior with a bow and arrow. And I was so disturbed by the image. I didn't understand it. I didn't want the image. It felt like it was completely off to me. It didn't make any sense. Genuinely upset with the image. And I can tell you, though, I mean, in terms of the way we've talked about Jung's process of active imagination and engaging and the way the shamans engage, I thought to myself, I think I have some work to do here because this is so disturbing. You know, I think I'm going to have to engage the warrior and be in dialogue with the warrior to understand the messages that were in there for me. And really, as I engaged the warrior, you know, the messages that were coming through was that I actually needed to be more discerning in my relationships, that I needed to be setting better boundaries, that I actually needed to be protecting myself, even within the context of some of my relationships. And looking back at it now, this was a journey that I took many years ago. That image, as disturbing as it was to me at the time, was such a gift. And honestly, in hindsight, it was really even prophetic in nature. Because I can tell you that, you know, what's unfolded over the last several years is that, you know, I'm in relationship very differently than I was at one point in my life. I'm much more able to speak my truth. I have certainly set much better boundaries. I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of relationships that I'm in today that are much richer and deeper as a result of that process. But, you know, the other side of it is, I don't want to sugarcoat this process. It was also incredibly difficult and incredibly painful in some cases, because as you make these changes, I mean, there was basically a shift in consciousness that was occurring for me that was playing out in my relational life. So there were other relationships that couldn't withstand that change. And some of them, honestly, were maybe perhaps a bit of a relief, but then there were others where the loss of those relationships were quite painful, but nonetheless necessary. So while the energy or the image of the warrior came to me many years ago, it's still operating in my life today. And it's in part because I continue to engage the warrior. I continue to engage the teachings that are there. I mean, that is the key piece. It's why we call it engaging the consciousness of change. It's why Jung didn't just call it imagination, he called it active imagination, you know, that you're actively engaging in this process. because there's teachings that are continuing to be revealed to me. And it's not unlike, I don't know if you've ever done any, you know, dream work, where, you know, you may interpret a dream that you've had, but you could really interpret a good dream for a couple of decades if you wanted to. There'd be more and more teachings in it all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think the point of it is the engagement. And I think the other thing, and one of the reasons I've shared this example, this particular example, is what still remains striking to me is how incredibly foreign that image was to me when it came to me. That it felt ego-dystonic. It just seemed like it wasn't my image, my discomfort with it, how much I didn't want it, how much I didn't understand it. And yet, there was so much teaching in that image for me. I never imagined several years ago that the relational landscape of my life would look as different as it does today, and how incredibly difficult that change was. And I think the thing of it as well, I mean, what I find striking about it as well, is that the warrior was bringing consciousness to an area of my life that was needing changes in a way that I couldn't even fully understand at the time. And it ultimately resulted in a death of a pattern of relating for me, and actually in many ways a death of a part of me, so that something new could emerge. So that's a bit of an understanding of, you know, how the shamans work in terms of the journey work. And there's a lot of different rituals that they use, and we don't have the time to really go into them all tonight. But there's the shamans also work with rituals that involve Amazonian plants of ayahuasca and San Pedro. And it's interesting now that science is now shedding new light on the impact of these Amazonian plants. There's an award-winning documentary entitled The Shaman and Ayahuasca, Journey to Sacred Realms by Michael Weiss. And in there, there's a professor, Professor Hildago. He's a biochemist, and he specializes in the study of Amazonian plants. And he discusses the impact of ayahuasca on the brain. And he says is the chemical structure of ayahuasca actually interconnects both the right and left hemispheres of the brain. And he adds that it's the connection to the cerebellum and the limbic system that results in a hypersensitivity to the knowledge that it already exists within and among us. And that when the rational and the non-rational connect, it allows for a flight of imagination connecting us to the cosmos and giving life meaning. And if you don't mind, I think it's PowerPoint 27. This one I can't do from here. Is that right?
The film clip. Yeah.
Ayahuasca by itself with the Baniesterase copy would not be able to affect the brain.
Lo que quiere decir que entre estas dos plantas,
what that means is that between those two plants,
hay un principio de complementariedad.
There's a principle of complementarity.
Uno refuerza la actividad.
One reinforces the activity.
Psicodélica de la otra planta.
Psychedelic of the other one.
De esta forma pueden llegar.
By this means, they can arrive
al cerebro.
They can reach the brain.
Interconectar los dos hemisferios cerebrales.
They interconnect both hemispheres, brain hemispheres.
Interconectar también el cerebelo y el sistema límbico.
Did I do that? I might have. Sorry, I'm putting this down.
Connects also the cerebellum and the limbic system.
Y lo maravilloso está entonces
and the wonderful thing is in
en que los hemisferios cerebrales
the brain hemispheres
se van a sensibilizar para aportar el legado de conocimientos que ya uno posee.
They become so hypersensitive to the knowledge we already have.
La parte racional, digamos, de la conciencia humana.
The rational part of the human brain.
Y aquella parte,
and that other part,
aparentemente no racional,
not rational,
que está en el sistema límbico,
that's in the limbic system,
poder permitir un vuelo de imaginación creadora.
It allows a flight of imaginative creation.
Y una conexión,
and a connection with
cósmica.
But it allows a cosmic connection.
And he goes on later in this segment, and we don't have time to show you more, but he goes on later to talk about how the expansion of consciousness that it can occur during an ayahuasca experience can often be experienced as a death. So that ayahuasca actually creates a space where one can find in death the beginning of a new life. He has a quote in there that's beautiful, I think. He says, it is to die to be born again, to live to die again. And what's compelling about that is also, you know, what Jung talked about in terms of, he said, the old king must die, long live the new king. So it's the death of an old structure of consciousness or of an old dominant function, so that death is both allows for and accompanies change. So we don't ever really want to sugarcoat changing our consciousness. It's not unlike the example that I gave, that there was really, you know, there was a birth of consciousness that I experienced through the image of the warrior, but it resulted in a death of a part of me too. So let's see, where are we here? And now I would like to share with you, you know, we've had some things to think about here in terms of Jung's process and also a little bit of a discussion in terms of how the shamans work. And Barbara and I are working, I want to share with you now how Barbara and I are actually working with this material to actively engage and change as a way of life. So we found that this is like an attitude or a way of living that is really relevant to all of us. We're not trying to propose a psychological theory, but rather a way of being. Intentionally being present to the energetic fields of consciousness or source is more of a spiritual practice, not a psychological technique. It's a way of living. So we have found this process both personally but also with those that we work with, that it can really result in a heightened feeling for life and like an enhanced life energy, and somehow life just seems to become more animated and purposeful and even intentional, actually. And as Barbara talked about, you know, Jung's psychic life insisted on a creative process, in order for him to remain engaged with all the energies that existed in the field for him. And so he was so courageous in engaging in this process of change in such completely uncharted territories for both him personally and for his time. But he responded to the demand of his own psyche and insisting on a movement and on a change of consciousness. So as Barbara talked about that process of active imagination, you know, he related to the images that appeared to him as separate from his ego self. He not only related to them, he argued with them. He understood the energies of real as real, and through that process really created a sense of meaning through those experiences that changed his consciousness. And it's striking to me how similar Jung's process of active imagination resembles that of the journey work by shamans. So we're drawing on his work and also on other schools of thought that we don't have the, you know, we can't really get into the Buddhism tonight and neuroscience and some of our other lectures that are longer. We go more broadly into those fields to begin to look at some of their intersecting points in terms of expanding consciousness. But we do believe, Barbara and I do believe, that consciousness exists in all things, and that the process of engaging these energetic fields of connection are limitless. That it's not necessarily just a process of engaging inner images, but if consciousness exists in all things, then there's teachings available for us in all moments and in all things. So we're going to look, this is an overview of our work, why engage with information gained from various kinds of consciousness, how to engage, we'll spend a little time with that, how to manage or encourage transformation, and what is our responsibility. So why engage? It goes back to an earlier slide, and this is to gain clarity, direction in our lives, guidance, to be able to connect to the potential, the fields of potential, and receive the energy from those sources, to use the information to make meaning and create a new story for ourselves in our lives, to expand consciousness. And really, I think the more you live in the field in this kind of way, it deepens the connection over time. In terms of how to engage, you know, there's a variety. There's a lot of, really, it's limitless, but I do want to give some examples. You know, it can come through our dreams, or sometimes your first thoughts upon awakening. You know, when you're kind of in that hypnagogic state right before you're fully conscious, what's drifting around in there? It could be a strong sense of intuition. Sometimes a sudden insight, I call it a download, right? Or synchronistic events that may be happening in your life. You know, what is that deep sense of longing within you? You know, that's what's trying to come through there. Can you actually engage that and ask it and wonder what it's about? It might be material that could come through meditation, journaling, insights that are gained through yoga, breathing, or energy work, or body work, connections in nature, you know, maybe like the one I gave an example of. It could be stories and images, novels, literature, art, music that moves you. You know, so really, you know, Barbara and I try to, in our workshops, help people connect to the energetic fields of consciousness in these sort of ways. The most important thing is everyone has their own way. You know, I tend to connect more in nature. I tend to get a lot more information through my dreams, you know, synchronistic events as well. But everyone can have their own portal and their own way, and helping people discover what that way is. Why is somebody completely drawn to a particular book that they're reading? Why are you reading that book now? What's in there for you? Or why is there a particular media story? Or how many times have I gotten in the car getting ready to go to work with a question and turn on the radio and of course there's the song with the answer, right? I mean, that it really, it's something that is all around us, right?
One of my friends says, shuffle is a voice of the self.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And that I think, too, is embrace not knowing. It's an important piece. I mean, sometimes consciousness can occur, a shift in consciousness can occur in a flash. You know, other ways, like the example that I gave you with the warrior, it's one that I struggled with, I wrestled with. It's unfolding over time, over years, really. And so sometimes we have to hold not knowing, but the point is to hold it and not to let it go.
We're going to take you on a mini journey so that you can actually have some little bit of experience with this yourself, like experience it. This is a journey that we learned from our friend Carl Greer through the shamanistic tradition, and it's called Journey to the Quiet. And the quiet is, as Doris said, it's the place before, it's like the Buddhist emptiness. It's the place before the matrix of our conscious mind was set. You know, and so I'm going to ask you if you want to take the journey.
Dim the light.
Yeah, can we dim the lights just a little bit? As we said, you need to, in order to engage with something that's outside of your mind, you have to alter your state of consciousness a little bit, you know, and have a more subdued sense of state of consciousness to let this in. So if you'd like to take this little journey with us, you can follow my directions. Otherwise, you can, sit and breathe and watch, and it's just for a few minutes. So if you sit with your feet solid on the ground and bring in, and that's sort of to bring your energy down off out of your head and even out of the transcendental space and into your seat and into the chair. Be heavy in the chair. And just watch your breathing for a minute. Then we're going to just breathe into the count of five, hold to the count of five, and exhale to the count of five. So breathe in, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hold, 2, 3, 4, 5. Exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we'll do this twice more. So inhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hold, 2, 3, 4, 5. And exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. And follow your own rhythm. You may not be on my count. Inhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hold, 2, 3, 4, 5. And exhale, 2, 3, 4, 5. And just watch your breath. And imagine that you're walking through a tunnel. And in this tunnel, you begin to go faster and faster into a run. And then suddenly you're flying through the tunnel. And as you come out the other end of the tunnel, you enter a crystalline field, a field of crystal and light. And as your body travels through that field, the crystal and light start to cleanse and reorganize your body and your cells into their own vibration, into the vibration of the crystal and the light. So take your time traveling through this realm of crystal, like your body's almost transparent with the crystal light going through it. When you emerge through that crystalline atmosphere, you come to the quiet, a place before any kind of thinking has been implanted in your brain, trained, programmed. And I'd like you to pose a question there that you'd like to have answered. Advice, possibly. And just ask that question to the quiet. It can be personal, it can be philosophical. And then listen or look or hear and see if you're given any kind of an answer. It could be in an image, a sound, a feeling, an emotion or body sensation, a memory. Try very hard not to just passively wait for the answer to come to you if it does, and not to think it up or make it up, not to let your mind make it up. If there isn't an answer, that there isn't one today. You can ask for clarification. You can ask a couple more questions to make it make sense to you. And then you can ask one more question, which is, what does the quiet, what do you want from me in return? It's an interactive process. What can I do? Then say your thank yous and say maybe you'll be back if you need to, if this journey is, works for you. And we'll go back the way we came. You go back again through the fields of crystal and light, having another opportunity to set your body and your vibrational field and your cellular structure in order and cleansed, like you're transparent going through this energy field. Then you'll find yourself into the tunnel, shooting through the tunnel, slowing down to a run, and then to a walk, and then you come outside the tunnel into normal reality, and you can open your eyes and be with us back here, and you can thank the source or quiet for giving you the information that it did give you, if it did. Okay, we can have the lights again. Okay. So you might take a minute to remember, just keep in your conscious mind if you did get any information, what you got. And maybe, as Doris said, over time, it will mean more to you than it does right now. Or maybe you know what it means. I personally, and everybody has their own way, I usually do not get images. I'm not a visual person. That is not the way. I mean, for a Jungian analyst, it's pretty odd, but yeah, it's It's not the way I get information. I usually just get intuitions, or I can feel things in my body. You know, everybody has their own way of getting mm-hmm. information. And if you start practicing this and you begin to trust your way of getting the information and validate it instead of, oh, that's nothing, whatever, we sort of blow it off.
And I think mm-hmm. I just want to add, too, just yeah. if something did come up for you, you know, we're going to be moving along in the lecture now, but, you know, go back to it, you know, journal, dialogue with it, you know, whether it's later on tonight or tomorrow or at some point, you know, you may want to engage that image more than you had a chance to do here tonight.
You know, we've tried to make the point that, you know, sometimes change can be, you know, just lovely, but often change is change, and it's big, and it makes, you know, it's like a atomic, mm-hmm. and that's my experience with some of it. And it's, you know, that's why when people come to therapy, for example, everybody says they want change, but like change is like change. Like, so it's not small. We have made this, you know, a devoted practice in our life and try to see the world this way. Try to walk around. Mm-hmm. We make a bold attempt anyway to walk around the world mm-hmm. looking and feeling for messages, working with them, trying to be open to the message. It's like karma yoga. You know, it's like making a yoga practice of your daily life, that this is how I want to live. And it really does enliven and enrich your life and make it less flat, you know, but it, it's also something else. there are forces that want to interfere with change. You know, the new neuroscience, which is sort of the cutting edge of my field, is like tells you that there are these entrenched neural pathways that you have in your brain. Often they're, if they're early trauma, they're in the lower part of the brain, and they're in feelings and emotions and reactions that you have, mm-hmm. and they're habits and patterns. They're also, you know, voices from the patriarchy, let's say, that get in the way. You know, your stupid intuition is like ridiculous, and the things we're doing are dumb, and or even worse, you know, and you have to start paying attention and being aware of these voices. And, you know, as a practicing Buddhist, like the first noble truth is we're all stuck in our stuff. And it's we all are suffering and trying to become conscious. And if you realize that everybody's trying to do that, or if they're not aware of it, they're so stuck and really in trouble, that you can look at everything compassionately. It doesn't mean you have to take everything from anyone and that you have to not set boundaries or anything like that, but you can think, wow, I'm stuck, you're stuck, you know, let's like try to be compassionate to each other in that. There are ways to help yourself in this process if you're going to really make this a devoted practice. And sometimes your spiritual belief that you're following now is this practice for you. Mm-hmm. And it is already a devoted practice to you. And if you surround yourself with like-minded people who they may not follow the same path, but they have the same purpose of becoming more conscious and becoming more aware, it's very supportive. You can ritualize your practice, like meditation every day, or yoga practice, or going over your dream journal in the morning, or going for a walk in nature and interacting with nature. Is that me or you?
You've said a little bit about it already.
Yeah. What do you think? I'm worried about time.
Worried about time. Yeah. I think what I might add for this particular piece is, you know, oftentimes when there's a shift of consciousness that's occurring, you know, it's something new that's emerging, right? And because, you know, we could look at it from the neuroscience perspective that Barbara just laid out, there can be an internal process where there's like an inner bully or an inner perpetrator, so that we say, you know, I am going to go ahead and write that book. Well, who do you think you are? Who's going to want to read it, right? We all know that inner bully, right? So it makes a shift in consciousness and a change that we're really trying to integrate tough, because it takes a courage, I think, to make a shift in consciousness, right? And then we have the inner bully that emerges in the middle of that, and then we have the outer, because oftentimes the people around us don't want us to change either. You know, so it is. It's quite the hero's journey. And it's not for the thin skin. We don't ever want to sugarcoat the process of creating a shift in consciousness. I mean, it can be beautiful too. You know, I don't want to just paint it out to be a dark thing.
Really negative.
But yeah. To know that that is inherently a part of the process. It is not a personal flaw. That the bully will emerge, and we just have to wrestle with it.
There's a wonderful little story that I like, and it's about the Persian poet Hafiz. Daniel Ladinsky wrote a book about him and had a lot of his poetry in the book. And one of the translations of the poem or the little talk is, it's called "The Subject of Tonight is Love." Did I make a slide of this?
Yeah, we do have a slide.
There,
yeah,
it is. Okay, here we go. Once the young woman asked Hafiz, "What is the sign of someone knowing God?" Hafiz remained silent for a few moments and looked deep into the young person's eyes and then said, "Dear, they have dropped the knife. They have dropped the cruel knife most so often used upon their tender selves and others." So I think we did. We just want to end with a little bit of conversation about, since this is an interactive process, we feel like we have a responsibility, a deep responsibility in the process.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason, right? There's an point to engaging these fields. You know, it's creating a shift in consciousness within oneself, but then what does that mean about how you are in the world? You know, if the psyche really holds its own wholeness, seeks its own wholeness, which is what Jung talks about, then what's the point? The point is to live our lives differently. And how do we then live it within our own lives differently? How are we in relationship differently? But I feel like that it's even deeper than that, that there's like a collective call. There's a collective point that how are we contributing to the world in new ways with the new consciousness that we have.
And we all do that in our own way. Like, I, you know, in my practice, if I work, I call like the psychological practice my activism. It's like one person at a time in our interaction in a non-hierarchical sharing kind of way. Or giving, you know, we feel like it's our responsibility to give this talk. That's our way of giving back. But everybody, it can just be how you are with your family or in your garden, or but that you have this consciousness and energy, and that changes the energy of the world.
It does, and that there's a multiplicity to the field, right? So that there is something to be said. Barbara and I also run groups, and you know, about having that sort of board of directors, like-minded people that are trying to sort of create shifts in consciousness for themselves, that those connections are so essential. And they enliven the field, because now my psychic energy is in the room with all of your psychic energy, right? And what can that create?
It's pretty exponential.
It is very exponential.
Thank goodness.